What's up, everybody, and welcome into episode 2 of Trial by Media, Fair or Foul. And today we are talking about the prosecution's right to a fair trial. Is this even a thing? Is this a problem in our day and age? Does the prosecutor ever have to fight to make sure that they, their side, the prosecution, receives a fair trial? Because most of this is centered around a defendant's Sixth Amendment right. We have to make sure we don't infringe on all of the defendant's rights, which would provide them a fair trial. But some people don't fully understand that the prosecution has that same right, and oftentimes it needs to be balanced throughout the process. And one of the biggest ways that it can be infringed upon is via the media or the public, because prosecutors do in fact represent the people, the public of whatever jurisdiction it is that they fight for. And to help me walk through today's podcast, discuss cases that this has happened in before, case law that we pull from to try to figure out what those rights are, I have my associate JD Patel and my partner Pete Sardis. What's up, everybody?
How's it going, Peter?
We're here. We're ready to rock. And I think that to kick off the podcast, one of the really important things is, where does this come from? Like, a prosecutor's right to a fair trial. Are we just saying everybody gets a right to a fair trial, or is there something specifically that sets out what a prosecutor's right is?
So there's not really something that's set out, but case law is pretty clear that the Supreme Court, from the state level, the federal level, that the prosecution has a right to present its case and offer evidence against the person they're charging. And they pretty much have free rein for the most part on how they do that, subject to the rules of evidence.
Okay, so where does that pull from, Pete, though? It's got to start from somewhere. It can't just be from case law.
Yeah, I mean, it all starts, relatively speaking, with the Sixth Amendment. And that is the, you know, obviously the amendment that allows for a guarantee of a fair and impartial trial for a defendant. And that is conveyed also to the prosecutor. There's also the right for the state to have a fair and impartial trial.
So some of the things we talked about last episode, that the defendant is guaranteed as part of the process, fair and unbiased jurors, to make sure that people are sequestered, whether it be witnesses, whether it be jurors, they're not going out there and doing research. They're not going out there and we don't have a runaway jury situation, somebody that's getting on there for a cause to make sure the defendant ends up not guilty. A lot of those same applications or rules of fairness apply to the prosecutor as well. But what else that's specific to prosecutors, JD, comes into play when we talk about guaranteeing them a right to a fair trial?
So one thing that's really important to know is that when a trial goes to the jury and they ultimately decide the verdict, whatever that verdict may be, if it's not guilty, the state doesn't get a right to appeal that verdict. So on the front end, it's important that the state's rights are protected, because unlike the defendant, where they get to appeal, the state doesn't get to do that. So the fact that everybody needs a fair and impartial jury, very important. Basically, that's the biggest thing, is that they need to have a fair and impartial jury in order to properly present the case to. And if that doesn't happen, then that's the issue.
They also need a judge to be fair and impartial throughout the process, because there are so many decisions a judge makes throughout the case. And that's really what can, you know, we all hope that judges are the gatekeepers and only relevant and admissible evidence should come in under the rules of evidence. But if the judge makes a wrong call, like you said, keeps something that's really important out for the prosecution, they believe that it should come in and it goes to trial. And, you know, we heard Binger and Rittenhouse's case argue that the judge was biased against him, or I should say infer that the judge was biased against him. Certain calls they made, Rittenhouse not guilty, nothing Binger can do. Can't appeal it, can't get a second bite of the apple because of double jeopardy in our country. So it is really important. I think that's good to highlight the importance of why prosecutors need a fair trial. What are some things, Pete, in the past that have been found to be an unfair trial as far as the prosecutors go? And let's try to weave the media into this too, right?
All right.
We know that the prosecutors have a right to a fair trial. How does the media affect that?
You know, again, you've got to understand that there is the rule of law. This country is based on that principle. And a prosecution has to have the right to go forward, because, again, if a prosecutor can't prosecute, that means criminals can do whatever they want. and it becomes a free-for-all, society breaks down. That's why it's important. But there have been a number of cases that talk about a defendant's right, and I'll kind of meld into this, to a fair trial. And that's when prosecutors are allowed to bring up issues that they believe affected the potential fairness of a verdict from the prosecution's perspective. So again, like JD said, the prosecutors don't have a right to appeal an acquittal. But if a defendant files an appeal based on a conviction, then the prosecutors have the right to bring up issues. And a lot of the issues have been, especially media bias, is huge. Basically saying that the media has, you know, caused such a kerfuffle in a particular case that the prosecutors cannot get a fair shake because they can't get an impartial jury. And it normally happens in cases where there is let me just say vigilante cases. Sometimes, for those of you that don't know what vigilantes are, it's when people take the law into their own hands. So in a vigilante case, the prosecution might be in a situation where the jury actually is in favor of the defendant because the defendant may have done something, in order to promote personal justice, but it's still a crime because people don't have the right to take justice in their own hands. So when the media has portrayed a particular defendant in a light that causes them to not be able to get a fair and impartial jury, you see a lot of cases in those areas where the media's right to to cover a case or to have access to portions of the trial gets curtailed the second time around, meaning when the case goes back in front of the judge for the second trial.
So when we have situations where the media affects case negatively, and most of the time we're thinking about the criminal defendant, because let's be honest, the majority of the time when you hear how heinous the facts of a crime are, people usually get behind the prosecutor and against the criminal defendant. But as it can be unfair that way, the pendulum also swings back the other way, where there are cases where either it's a celebrity criminal defendant and people think they can do no wrong, or a politician or whatever it may be. And the media gets in a situation where they think it's prosecutorial misconduct, or they think that anybody that testifies against this person is complacent or is part of the problem or whatever it may be. And the media can intimidate or affect witnesses. They can affect jurors. They can affect the trial in the same way they can on the criminal defense side. So how do prosecutors fight against that, JD, when they feel the media may be infringing on their rights to a fair trial to do what they think is right as far as prosecute the law?
Yep. So they have the ability to do gag orders, and you're very familiar with that. That's happened throughout a lot of these cases that you've been covering. And a few of these cases, there was one in, it was the U.S. versus Timothy McVeigh. He was the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. The prosecution requested a gag order on that one to prevent the defense, who was actually going to the media as well, and the media from basically tampering with everything because it was not favorable to them. And from the state's point of view is, you want to get this done right the first time. You don't want, any hindrances along the way, because if you've got a slam dunk case, you want to do it right the first time and just be done with it. Because what could happen is, 12 years down the road, and I say 12 years because this is what happened in a certain case. It's one of the landmark cases, quite frankly, that touched on the media. It was about a husband who had killed his wife, and this was in 1954. And the media was so involved throughout the case, where they would go to his house, they would film him, and basically the coroner in that case made him reenact how his version of the events happened, and it just blew up entirely, right? They were printing wrong things, badgering him. They were investigating his mistress, and it basically ruined the case for the prosecution, because 12 years later, when it got to the Supreme Court, it ended up reversing one of the parts of it, and they ordered the district court to grant the writ of habeas corpus and basically release him. So as a prosecutor, you wouldn't want that to happen down the road.
So you made two really, really good points there that I want to take a second and talk about. The first one is a criminal defense attorney going to the media, talking to the media, you could say leaking it or coloring certain evidence or explaining things the way they want to explain it, especially when you get certain high dollar private criminal defense attorneys that want to go out there and they want to control the narrative. That can absolutely affect a prosecutor's right to a fair trial. And that is one of the reasons we see gag orders and things like that come, or where lawyers, prosecutors specifically ask the judge, how about tell the lawyers they are not allowed to go out there and say stuff. And we have this Koberger case that's got this gag order that includes stuff like that. And it also includes that lawyers have to abide by the rules of ethics. It's like, yeah, you would think all lawyers already know they have to abide by the rules of ethics, but sometimes it ends up in a gag order. And that's the exact reason why, because the number one thing a prosecutor can't control throughout the process, because they, I don't want to say control the law enforcement, but they can control a lot of the law enforcement, a lot of the witnesses in the case, a lot of former judges or prosecutors, but they cannot control the criminal defense attorney. And that is one big area that can affect a prosecutor's right to a fair trial. Pete, any thoughts on that before I jump to number two?
You know, the truth of the matter is we saw that even, do you remember Casey Anthony here in Orlando? We saw that because that trial was basically, that trial before it even began was taken on the courthouse steps. It was a constant flurry of press conferences and press releases. And this person's a bad witness and that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And I think that all of that has a tendency to frustrate the legal process. And I understand from a criminal defense lawyer's perspective, it's the exact opposite argument, right? The defense lawyer wants to go out there and tell the media how innocent his client or her client is and how the, you know, the prosecution is either acting unfairly or, you know, is engaging in some sort of misconduct and kind of put that out there. That's really why the media is allowed into the courtroom to alleviate those problems. But a lot of lawyers use it to the advantage, and it does absolutely adversely affect a lot of prosecutions, because when all that stuff happens, now prosecutors are on heightened alert and they've got to do extra things in the abundance of caution that just make trials more expensive, lengthier, more complex, and just more difficult for all the parties and the witnesses.
So, yeah. And again, just so I'm clear, 99% of the time, I do not think that actually violates a prosecutor's right to a fair trial. I think that is an argument they can make in some cases with how the media is involved in what they do. I think if there is no gag order, there's nothing wrong with a lawyer going out there and talking about how the prosecution has no case or their client is innocent or they've got the wrong person. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think a line can be crossed, especially if the media, like you were saying, prints things that are wrong, right? Then the media can really affect the fair trial. If they're just taking quote unquote sources and misquoting them or using them for whatever their narrative is, or if they just want to be, you know, the person that zags when everybody else is zigging and writing some story that's the opposite of what everybody else is just to try to get clicks or whatever it is these days, that can really become a problem. The second thing JD mentioned that I thought was really important throughout this podcast is the right to a fair trial the first time. And you went off and talked about Timothy McVeigh and how it was, and then the other case with the husband and how some of the unfair media attention that's negative to the defendant can actually create an unfair trial for the prosecutor. Now that may seem like a paradox, but in reality, if a criminal defendant is not given a fair trial because of the media, it also is an unfair trial for the prosecutor because they're spending all of their time, all their money, all their resources on trying this case that they're going to have to do all over again 12 years later. Now we've wasted the public's money. We've wasted the prosecutor's time. It could be new prosecutors. We could lose witnesses. And now they could be severely prejudiced if some witnesses passed away or some people are not able to testify with the same clarity they could have 12 years ago. And you're creating a situation where trial number two is prejudiced against the prosecution because the media infringed on the criminal defendant's rights. That is literally one of the major arguments made in the Koberger case, where both prosecution and defense agreed to this gag order. All the parties, right? The parties, the prosecutor and the defense, they agree to a gag order because they all want a fair trial because a second trial is unfair for everybody, basically. Yep. Were you going to say something, Pete? You like raised your hand?
Well, no, that's all right. I'll get into it.
Where are you going, JD, with that?
Yeah, I actually had a case when I was at the state. It was a traffic homicide case where an 18-year-old was killed and a 14-year-old. And the 18-year-old, he was very involved in the community. And his mom essentially was going to the media and, you know, rightfully doing what she wanted to do to I guess, ensure justice, let's call it. But I kept telling her, I said, look, you need to let me do my job because ultimately the effects that what you're saying could do, like, could be negative to the case and it could affect me in a different way that you know, she's like, I could take you to the street and do street justice. No, we don't want to do that, right? Because that's only going to make things worse ultimately. So it definitely has an adverse effect. And, you know, again, I'd rather do it right the first time than bear the consequences and have to retry it.
See, and what happens is, and we've talked about this before, the distinction between the media's right to report on the case at hand as opposed to an entertainment. It's when the courtroom becomes a forum for entertainment as opposed to justice, that's when things start falling apart, and they fall apart very quickly.
Yeah. And I think that's the point, is kind of what JD was just saying too. Mm-hmm. The prosecutor's right to a fair trial also comes down to the prosecutor's actions, right? They have to be careful about what actions they take. And again, there's multiple reasons for that. Number one, you are a prosecutor. So what you can say is even more limited than just a lawyer's, you know, rules of ethics. Number two, the criminal defense attorney, we've talked about this before in cases, criminal defendant and criminal defense attorney have so much more leeway with what they try to get in. If they say things that are objectionable or they lose objections throughout the trial, it doesn't matter, because if they win, it can't be appealed. And if they lose, everything they did wrong doesn't matter, because they're going to appeal and try to find something the prosecutor did wrong. So the prosecutors, on the other hand, have a tighter leash on what they can do, what they can say in front of the media. And one of these that I can really remember is the Making a Murderer, Stephen Avery documentary that they did on Netflix. It was like the most scummy prosecutor ever, going out, trying to color the media, trying to color the press and all potential jurors, poison the jury pool. It's talking about stuff that wasn't even true. And then at the end of the case, he ends up texting with some witness, like hitting on her, and he ends up getting disbarred and stuff, all sorts of problems for him at the end. But you could just tell he was that kind of guy in front of the press, and he is making it unfair for his own side with how he's acting, because if you create an appellate issue yourself, then you're not going to end up with a fair trial. And I think it's really interesting to kind of dive into a topic like this, because I think most people think this is not a problem. And I think when they say that, they mean most of the time people want justice. They want the bad guy behind bars. They want the state attorney to win, the state attorney or the prosecutor. The prosecutor is with law enforcement, whether it's local law enforcement, federal agents, whatever it may be. And it all usually lines up with what the media narrative is. But even when that's the case, like in a Koberger situation, the state still usually, more often than not, the state is in favor of a gag order. It's usually the defense, if you can believe that, that doesn't care for a gag order or doesn't want a gag order. Why do you think that is?
I mean, they get a chance to muddy the waters. Any chance they can to get any misinformation out of there, you know, that's their goal ultimately. Because, for example, or let's say that the defense puts a story out there and the media helps portray that story and say that there are certain types of evidence that's out there. Now the prosecution's held to that, I don't call it a higher standard, but they have expectations. And when you have
I'm not going to say misinformation, but they put information out there that could potentially muddy the waters. And exactly what you're saying, like correct. The CSI stuff. That's why we talk about it in jury selection. If they say something like Koberger's lawyers did in the motion, there's no DNA evidence in the car. So it's like, oh, you guys have all this CSI technology and you couldn't find any blood. You couldn't find any sweat. You couldn't find any DNA in the car, or you couldn't find anything else besides what's on the sheath. When in reality, as a prosecutor, you prove a lot of cases without that stuff.
Right. I mean, it just makes the expectations so much higher when it's unneeded. And again, that's their goal, right? I mean, that's the way, that's the best way for defense attorneys to attack the case when their client may be dead in the water.
Right. And it is misinformation, because at the end of the day, and we watch an episode of CSI, use that as an example, and they get the blood sample that then gets the, they send it to the lab and they come back with a result, right? And it all happens in a 30 minute or 1 hour episode. People don't realize that the reality of how long it takes to gather that evidence, the chain of custody requirements to send it to the lab and for the lab to actually produce a result is months in the making. So, you know, again, a lot of that is using what the average person believes is the science, but it's not really scientific. It's purely the entertainment value of that science that they're used to, and trying to use it against a prosecutor and say, oh, look, CSI does it in 30 minutes. Why can't you all do it? It's been 6 months.
Yeah, I still wouldn't say that's misinformation. I still think saying that there's no DNA evidence or they don't have anything connecting the client to the case is not misinformation if it's actually true in the case. Now, what you're saying is maybe they're elevating the burden higher than it should be. And I think a lot of times defense attorneys will explain that beyond a reasonable doubt as seeming like 100% certainty when it's not, or as high as you can. Were you going to say something, JD?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. So I also think, so, and again, continuing with the interesting thought that prosecutors are usually a lot more likely and interested in a gag order than criminal defense attorneys, which again, I think would surprise people because usually the media narrative is pro-prosecution. But I think that also comes back to a lot of criminal defense attorneys realize that prosecutors are not going to be as vocal. They're not going to have as many press conferences. If they do, it's like the state attorney or the U.S. attorney or the attorney general, right? And in some cases, they will go out and do stuff like that. But in most cases, a criminal defense attorney will be louder and out there and giving information, especially when they feel like they have something to work with, or just to say something like they do not have enough to prove this crime. And I think they usually feel like that is helpful to their case, whether it's muddying the water, whether it's providing some information that's elevating burdens, whatever it may be, they are more likely, we've been prosecutors, criminal defense attorneys, usually the information and way that we can talk to the media is something that is seen as a benefit. I think it can go the other way. And there are some people, like, I think one of the first videos I ever did on YouTube was, I think it was one of the guys representing the January 6th, one of the January 6th guys. And there was like video of his client carrying stuff through the Capitol. And he was like, well, they have the video, so I'm not really sure what we're going to do about it. It's like, yeah, that's probably a press conference you shouldn't have done, buddy. You know, like it can go the other way when you do a bad press conference. Right. But I think most of the time criminal defense attorneys think that they can talk to the media more and prosecutors won't talk as much, especially line assistants that are actually handling the case if it's not the highest profile case where you get the state attorney on it.
Yeah, and I think you've got to be careful as a defense lawyer about what your motivation is for going in front of those cameras. I think a lot of people want to get in front of the camera because they find that it's good advertising, it's good marketing for the lawyer, but they're not really thinking, is this good for my client? Because especially in today's world where media is all recorded and you can go back and look at it, the worst thing is when defense lawyers get up there and say, there's absolutely no evidence of X or there's no evidence of Y. And well, all of a sudden there's evidence of X and Y. Mm-hmm. You've screwed your client.
Yeah, you got to be careful what you say. And it's also interesting, like a couple criminal defense attorneys, Mark Iglarsh, and Harpootlian and Murdoch's case, they don't apologize, but they say in opening statements, don't hold anything that you feel, any animosity you feel about me against my client. I'm going to have to cross-examine witnesses. I know my dad does stuff like this sometimes. So he's like, I may seem hard on some witnesses. Don't take it out on my client. I'm just representing my client, doing the best I can, holding the prosecution's feet to the fire. That's what we're supposed to do. Hold them to their burden. And I think that can be flipped in press conferences, like Pete said, where sometimes they do hold an attorney against their client and they do not like a client because of how the attorney acts publicly. And I do think that's something that criminal defense attorneys don't think about enough. Another thing that I think is interesting with media in the prosecutor's case is if a criminal defense attorney is going on the courthouse steps, like Pete mentioned, I think it was the Casey Anthony case or whatever case it was, when they are doing that, even if they're not necessarily violating a prosecutor's right to a fair trial, the more you do that, the more likely a prosecutor is going to be able to convince a judge that a gag order is needed. Because if they can make arguments like JD did that they're raising the burden, or like Pete did, where they're just saying stuff that's not true, misinformation or information that comes out later to debunk whatever it is they're saying, that is more evidence a prosecutor needs for a gag order. What other things can you think of or have you seen in cases that prosecutors may try to use to limit media attention or protect their right to a fair trial to make sure it's not trampled on by the media or criminal defense attorneys via the media?
A lot of times what you'll see is the prosecution will ask the judge to close the courtroom for specific witnesses, especially witnesses that are sensitive. For example, there's case law on this. It was a case where there were some gang members that had turned state's evidence, meaning that they were testifying on behalf of the prosecutors against some other gang members. And the prosecution wanted to close the courtroom during that testimony.
Some people would call them something that rhymes with ditch. I don't know if you're trying to explain when you said turn state's evidence.
Yeah. So let's just presume that is the case. But listen, the problem then becomes the prosecutors have to protect their witnesses too, because the last thing they want is those witnesses' testimony to get out, at which point, you know, the other witnesses now are at risk, at jeopardy of physical violence, which is what happened in some of these cases. And that's kind of the balancing act that we've talked about in the past, about the right to a the defendant's right to fair trial and the right to the media access is, you know, is got to be even. And if at some point the media's effect has a negative effect on the proceedings, the media's got to lose every time.
And a lot of times the media, because if there is media on a case or it's a high profile case, prosecutors will be even that much more protective of those kinds of witnesses or undercover agents, putting up screens, masks, whatever, especially if you're going, you know, distort the voice, whatever it may be, especially if it's not just going to be the people in the courtroom or the old school public, as we used to think, people that could actually walk in and sit in the gallery, but also cameras being there. And so that's a good point as to another way prosecutors can try to ensure they get a fair trial is closing the courtroom or, you know, some kind of mask or whatever to protect witnesses.
And it's not even just the witnesses. It's also the potential veneer because, mm-hmm. you know, nowadays in the bigger cases, you can get, you know, you'll get your veneer members, you know, ahead of time. So you can kind of vet them initially. But in one of the cases back in the 60s, it was the one that I was mentioning before where the husband had murdered the wife. They had actually released, it was 25 days before the case went to trial. All the prospective jurors, or 75 of them, their names were released into the public. So all three medias, like the main, you know, newspaper, whatever it was, the companies, they published the names and they were getting harassed for the next 2 to 3 weeks, essentially. And I mean, that's just atrocious is what it is. I mean, there's no reason that should happen for mm-hmm. both sides.
Yeah. And I mean, if you just want to have an example of a case where there is at least a section of the population that is heavily in favor and vocally and vehemently in favor of a criminal defendant in a high profile, violent criminal case, look no further than the YNW Melly case that ended in a mistrial because there was 1 to 3 holdout jurors that no matter what you were going to say, we're going to vote not guilty. They did everything they could to protect this case. We had masked witnesses. We had a sequestered jury while they were deliberating. And that is a case that media attention could affect the prosecutor's right to a fair trial, especially now that they have had an entire trial to watch and record. How are people going to talk about it now? There were some problems with the prosecution, in my opinion, throughout that case. And I think that could rise to a level of becoming an issue for them if the media were to go a certain way on them. Now, we haven't seen that yet, and the retrial is supposed to be in just a couple months, so maybe it won't happen. But there are cases. There are cases where people are heavily in favor of the criminal defendant. O.J. Simpson, yeah, Kobe Bryant. Simpson. A lot of times it's celebrity
yeah, I was gonna type ask that. Let me ask you this. Do you think it makes a difference if the defendant was actually a celebrity beforehand? Like, nobody knew who Brian Koberger was, right, before sure. this case. But people knew who O.J. Simpson was and Kobe Bryant, like, in his case. Does that make a difference?
Yes, I think it makes a major difference, especially on, like, the public perception of them. Because while Brian Koberger and, what's his name? I mean, the Oklahoma City bomber, whatever serial killer you want to get, BTK, whoever you want to mention. I shouldn't have said Koberger in the names with them because he is just the accused at this point. But if he were to get convicted, and even right now, any fame or cult following that he has is a specific type of person. And I'm not talking about the people that think he's innocent until proven guilty, which we're all in that camp, and presuming him innocent and holding the state to their burden and making sure they prove it. That's not the camp I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people writing him love letters, proposing to him, following his every move. That to me is a specific sect of people that really don't affect public perception or affect the case. Very different when you have an O.J. Simpson, a YNW Melly, a Kobe Bryant, who people love them because they are elite. They are great at what it is they do, and people love them for that. So they just could never imagine that they could do something violent or criminal or whatever it may be. And you know, whether it's R. Kelly or Bill Cosby, I mean, there's tons of celebrities that do things that end up coming back to bite them, and people still love them through the process. They swear that they are innocent. I think that it has everything to do with them being a celebrity and being genuinely great at something before they are accused of a crime.
Right. Yep. I mean, and understand, you said, you know, Bill Cosby. From my generation, Bill Cosby is Dr. Huxtable. He's the guy on the Jell-O pudding commercials. He's, I mean, anybody that grew up in, you know, with him at the height of his popularity, I mean, this guy was about as wholesome as you could be. And he was portrayed that way, and they protected that image. So when, you know, when somebody from my generation hears that Bill Cosby's in trouble for sex crimes, what? That's impossible. Not, you know, not Mr. Jell-O pudding. No way.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is whether they end up getting convicted or not, right? Because you have it across the board, whether it's R. Kelly or O.J. Simpson, whether it's Bill Cosby or Kobe Bryant. Some of them, the criminal charges stuck, they get convicted or whatever it may be. Sometimes they go away even after they get convicted. Sometimes they're not guilty. Sometimes the charges don't even go forward. But I definitely think celebrity has a big impact on how the media affects cases like this. And I think prosecutors push harder for gag orders in situations like this, again, for a couple of reasons. The media is less likely to be on their side and more likely that we're going to have a high-priced, high-dollar private criminal defense attorney on the other side that is going to be ready and polished to talk to the media about this case and try to convince the public and win the court of public opinion before they ever actually get into the court of law.
What's crazy was the George Zimmerman case, Trayvon Martin, prosecution and the defense both requested gag orders in that case, and the judge denied it. And the judge basically said, you know, we basically have the legal mechanisms in place for juror questioning, sequestration, to ensure an impartial jury. So, I mean, that was a crazy case. I mean, we all know it was right here at home, you know?
Yeah, well, and same thing with Murdoch. The parties were ready to agree to a more restrictive gag order than the judge would allow. He's like, I'm not closing off my courtroom when we have hearings and stuff. Like if you want to block certain documents or whatever, fine, we can do that on a case by case basis. But this is a public court. The public has interest in this case, and I think he handled it probably the best. He wasn't allowing for any shenanigans, some high profile lawyers in that case on both sides. And I think he did potentially the best job I've seen of anybody where there was a question as to whether or not there should even be a gag order. Cause not in every case do they ask for a gag order. Right. It happens in a lot of cases, especially high profile cases.
And remember, the law is clear. It is the least restrictive mechanism that's available. That's what the judge is obligated to instigate, to put into place, even if it's contrary to the defense lawyer and the prosecutor's wishes.
And the media has such a big part in that. And I think, I don't know, the next episode or one of these upcoming episodes, we are going to talk about the media's right in a process of a fair trial. And Judge Newman, I think, did a good job. It's been considered in lots of cases, in Lori Vallow's case, in the Murdoch case, like I said, in the Trayvon Martin case, whatever it may be. They do a good job of also considering the media's rights because, for the most part, as we all know, if the parties agree, why does the judge even need to get involved, right? If the parties agree, we're not going to let this evidence in, the judge isn't going to say you have to let that evidence in. If the parties agree, we're not going to call this witness, the judge isn't going to say you have to call this witness. If the parties agree, we're going to waive records custodian so we don't have to call a million witnesses, the judge is going to let that happen. He's not going to get involved there. But when other people's rights are involved, the judge steps in and is the gatekeeper and has to balance everybody's rights and make a call. And the media's rights, we're going to dig into, and that's really what it comes down to. So I want to save part of the conversation for that. But again, same thing with witnesses. We're going to talk about witness rights. If both the parties are like, they don't need to wear a mask, sometimes the witnesses can still ask the court that they need to wear a mask, especially if they're a undercover gang unit officer, something like that. So there are still situations where the court can overrule the wishes of the parties. Now, if they agree with the parties, then usually they're going to say, well, the party stipulated, so why should I step in? And we'll see that as well.
You say that until the extraordinary writs start getting thrown around and the judges have to deal with all that mess. Mm-hmm. Like writs of mandamus, writs of prohibition, things like that.
It's a good transition to talk about the judge here because the judge has some sort of, I don't know what the word is, but they've got a
duty.
A duty is not the right word. You know, they've got a bite, or I don't know what the word I'm talking about is here. I mean, they've got some incentive here, right? Because they're elected officials. So they want to be on these, or appointed, correct. Some of them, well, the elected officials, there's actually a Stanford article that came out in 2010 that covered how the media affects elected officials, or elected judges, rather. And on high-profile cases, the elected judges, when the defendant's found guilty, they usually sentence a lot higher and punish a lot more because they want to attract essentially those that fan base that you were talking about earlier that are for the prosecution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the judge definitely has a, you know, a bias in that sense too, because they want to get reelected.
They could be affected is the point. They could be affected. Sure. And again, I think that comes back into play for the defendant's rights, but we're also going to do an episode on how judges are affected by the trial by media. And I think that's a good point. And the media affects every aspect of the case, right? We dove deep in how they affect the criminal defendant. We dove deep today in how they affect prosecutors specifically, even in ways people may not have thought of, but again, in future episodes, we're really going to dive deep into judges. We're going to dive deep into the media and other aspects of a fair trial, whose rights are affected, especially by the media. So that's all we've got for today's episode. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We will be back next week with another episode. Thanks, Pete. Thanks, JD. Until next time, we're out of here. Thanks for watching another episode of The Lawyer You Know. If you enjoyed the episode, please hit the thumbs up and share with your friends who may be interested here on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Tragos Law is our handle. And don't forget to listen to The Lawyer You Know podcast featuring new episodes every week. If you have a case you want to talk to us about, if it's a personal injury case, wrongful death, catastrophic injury, car accident, or slip and fall case, please email us at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. And of course, all these links I just mentioned are included in the description below on this episode and every episode. So until next time, this is Peter Tragos, The Lawyer You Know.